Chapter 8. An Evaluation Culture. When Other Voices Decide. We live in a society where we are constantly being evaluated and judged, almost no matter what we do. If you go to a two-hour course, you have to evaluate the instructor, the teaching, the physical setting, the catering, the registration procedure, etc. If you're looking for a job, you often have to go through some psychological tests and profiling to see whether you fit within the company's profile. And right down to the daycare level, educators have to observe and assess whether a child is following the development curve. There is a whole system of evaluation that runs through several stages of our lives, whether it is daycare, school, or work. This tendency is causing more and more people to develop performance anxiety and generalized anxiety because we are constantly under some form of surveillance. Many of those I meet in my clinical practice have been negatively influenced by our evaluation culture. Subjective assessments. Evaluations already begin from a very young age when we are first registered in a system. Various reports about a child who attended a daycare center are transferred to the school where the child is now attending and read by professionals there. The professionals then also assess the child before they have even met them. The first assessment comes from the eyes that first saw the child, and thus this assessment continues to follow the child without new professionals having time to form their own independent opinions. Whether the assessments or development charts we ideally should follow are right or wrong is in itself irrelevant. But it does have an impact on how we develop when we are constantly assessed and compared from the time we are born. Every time an assessment is followed up by psychologists or other professionals, new assessments result in even more eyes scrutinizing the child, putting the child under psychological pressure. Their brain is still developing, and the development varies from child to child. Although we know this in theory, unfortunately, this does not always apply in professional practice. Here, one must follow the development chart and not the individual's own natural development. The people whom I meet in therapy often identify with low self-esteem. Many have performance anxiety and are constantly thinking about what others think about them. The many years of others' opinions towards them and various plans of action have affected them to such an extent that they feel different and less worthy. It is very easy to take the judgmental voice you have heard your whole life and turn it towards yourself. But these conclusions are not necessarily the truth just because they have been immortalized in a report. Even if there are professionals behind the assessments in, for example, daycare and school, these are still subjective assessments. And behind these assessments is the person being assessed. Stigmatization thus happens early, and it can be difficult to get rid of the voices that tell us how we are doing or whether we are good enough. A client once asked me what I thought of her. But it does not matter what I think, because my thoughts say more about me than her. It is not a question of whether or not we should evaluate one another. But it is a question of whether you can say something qualified and really useful to someone. You rarely can say something qualified if you have only met a child once, or been taught for 2 out of 20 lessons, or if you are blindly following a standardized plan. This does not mean that you should not be concerned with what your relatives or others think of you, because if you never think about the opinions and views of others, you tend towards the psychopathic. But nor can we live a life in which we are constantly wondering what others think about us, that we did not come to the big family reunion, or that we do not hold confirmations for our children, or that we do not eat enough organic food. The dangerous thing about evaluating children in particular is that very few children follow a rigid development plan. Often I see that children are expected to be able to do things that they may not be able to do, nor necessarily should be able to do at that stage in their development. There is no room to develop because everything has to occur in a particular way and at a certain pace. Some are fortunate to get through this, and others do not get through this without a report following them. The assessments for the youngest children are often based on some fixed chart that says what they should be able to do at age 3, at age 5, and so on. But how much importance is attached to these charts can be open to interpretation. One professional may deem it important for a child at daycare to be able to sit still, and another professional may consider that the child will learn to do so and that it is much more important for the child to know a certain number of words. These subjective assessments can vary from person to person and be dependent on the individual's professional background, age, life circumstances, or values. What is important for some may not be important for others. At one point, I read an evaluation about a child of 5. He cannot put his feelings into words. I wondered whether the boy was even allowed to have his feelings and show them, because is it not more important that there be room to have his anger or his sadness without having to be evaluated? And is it really so important that he cannot put his feelings into words right now? Because maybe he will be able to a year from now. Maybe he should just be allowed to have his feelings, to become familiar with them, and not to fear them. Already defined objectives. Often evaluations are about one behavior being more desired than another. It is good to be social. It is not good to be introverted. Some objectives have already been defined that tell us that we have to act in a certain way to fit in. These objectives might be that an employee at work should be more outgoing, or a job seeker should be able to manage herself in large gatherings. These objectives are often about being social in a particular way. But it is not the person being assessed who has defined these objectives. Others have done so. And that is why they often fail, because the person may not want to be social to the extent that others think would be good. The same applies to children. Did you just sit in your room again instead of playing with the others? And you must get used to eating with the other students and not just sit by yourself. And this also applies to adults. After all, it's important that you interact with your colleagues in the company. The fact that the child or adult then changes their behavior is not necessarily a criterion for success, because it can be purely based on behavioral change, where no work's been done on the psychological processes that need to be restructured to achieve real and lasting change. We can also teach a monkey to eat lunch with the others. For the child who forces herself out of her room, or for the employee who has taken the step of being able to stand in a room full of people, this change may have no lasting impact. He or she may even feel worse. The question is, for whose sake does one change? It may not be for one's own sake, and there may not be any inner motivation to correct the behavior. We often end up over-psychologizing. Everything must be explained, and everything must have a diagnosis. This tendency is especially worrisome when it concerns young children. At one point, I was at a lecture by a known doctor who asked the question in relation to ADHD-diagnosed children. For whose sake are we medicating these children? Is it for their sake? Is it for their parents' sake? Or is it for their teachers' sake? I have thought about this dilemma for quite some time since. It is possible that some children are more active than others, and it can well be that they have different challenges. But there is a tendency to create categories and boxes that are difficult for people to get out of. And it may be that we need to begin to discuss whether diagnoses have gotten out of hand, particularly in the case of children. We must be careful not to develop a view of human beings in which we only give people value when they fit into a certain mold. Normality. The extensive degree of external control also means that we can end up feeling wrong and abnormal. Our concept of when something is normal has changed over time. Normality is culturally and historically dependent, and what was normal in Denmark 100 years ago is not necessarily normal anymore. And what is normal in Denmark is not necessarily normal other places in the world, and vice versa. But it is important to remember that normality is a range. It is not a fixed point. In Denmark, the range of normality is shrinking, although very few are situated so close to the middle of the range. And if they are not, the machine kicks in. Your son can't sit still. We need to have a meeting about this. Or, you're not involved enough with your colleagues. We need to have a conversation about this. But the little boy will eventually learn how to sit still. And perhaps the company employee needs some time to be alone whenever there's a break. The rules of society and psychological rules are two different areas that do not always follow each other. And we cannot make rigid rules for our psychological lives. If we try to do so, we become stressed, and we do not function well under pressure for long periods of time. So we try to control some of our psychological processes by creating strict boundaries around them. But we cannot put psychological processes into a ready-made scheme and then expect to always follow the structure of the scheme. Is this a problem for you? One of the areas where we often meet rebukes and an abundance of good advice has to do with our use of social media. In the major daily newspapers and magazines, we can read opinions from experts that children do not benefit from sitting in front of a screen, and if they do, they should have clearly defined screen time. And for adults, the admonitions are that Facebook is a time consumer, taking time away from our families and our work, which we could do much more effectively if we just turned off the Facebook app altogether. I once had a student in a class who told me during the break that she'd been trying to cut down on the time she spent on Facebook for a long time. But she did not really want to reduce her time at all. And somehow, she could not quite understand why she should. So I asked her, "With your hand on your heart, how much do you want to change your usage?" "Well, I don't want to at all," she told me. "But it's embarrassing, because everyone else tells me that they've decided to be on Facebook only for a certain number of minutes a day. I haven't done this at all." Her desire was not defined by herself, but rather by some norms determined by others. So why let herself get frustrated about it? Sometimes you have to consider whether it is a desire you have or whether it is a desire for a behavior that others have dictated. If she thinks it's a problem herself, it's fine that she wants to change it. But if her Facebook time is not a problem for herself, she's unlikely to end up doing anything about it either. So my advice to her was to go crazy with Facebook until she did not want to do it anymore. Her time spent on social media had no consequences for her. She was doing her work and spending time with her children, and was fine with spending her alone time on Facebook. The small problem that becomes huge. All the systems and guidelines an individual finds themselves immersed in can end up making them ill and making a problem greater than it needs to be. A 22-year-old man went to me for a period of therapy. He had a touch of social phobia, but not to such an extent that he could not function. Despite this, he lived at home with his parents for long periods. His parents had adopted him when he was 1 year old, after many years of wanting a child. They found it hard to let go of him and leave him in charge so that he could have his own experiences. There was no doubt that his parents wanted the best for him, but they inadvertently kept him in a dependent relationship with them. Every time he went to therapy, either his mother or father provided a ride. Even when he lived on his own, he never had to take the bus because there was always someone to pick him up. He never got around to getting an education. A few months always went by before he dropped out of another course of study. "It's not so fun to go to school," he told me. And no, going to school is not necessarily as much fun as going to the cinema or a party. Education is not meant to be torture, nor is it meant to be bad to take an education. But there are other goals for taking an education than just having fun. It is great to make friends, and there can be some enjoyable experiences during the breaks, just as some of the teaching will be inspiring. But having fun all the time is not the underlying basis for getting an education. Besides not thinking it was fun, he also thought that too many demands were being made on him. His own theory was that he could not cope with all the people who went there. I asked him what his parents said about him not being able to take an education. "They can well understand, because if you have social anxiety, it's not possible," he said. He was therefore accommodated by his parents. In many cases, it is of course good to be accommodated by your parents. But the problem here was that by accepting his minimal level of social anxiety, his parents were confirming that he had a problem. Not just a small problem, but a problem so massive that for long periods he had to live at home and be transported by car from place to place if he had to go anywhere. The demands of society. Many people have a degree of social anxiety, or another type of anxiety, that makes them not particularly want to be in certain situations. But because we live in a society that makes specific demands of us, we cannot continue to support these reactions. Not because we should force people into situations that are not comfortable for them, but sometimes a bit of pressure and some consequences may be necessary. For my client, there was never any consequences. He was allowed to keep living at home. His parents did the shopping and cooking. He was able to go to parties and have a good time because, despite his social anxiety, he had friends, and he was able to do activities with his friends in his spare time. He was not much of a party person, but he did not isolate himself either. It was in relation to work and education that he could never accomplish anything, and usually it was because it was not fun. Both the municipal government and the employment center had started to make demands of him, and he was sent through long assessments that concluded that he had social anxiety and therefore could not do anything involving other people. He had also tried to go through various kinds of therapy, each time with no results and being told that he did not respond very well to therapy. For part of the time when he went to me, he lived on his own and started to get better. He wrote some job applications, looked into more education options, and also began going out more. I asked him to practice taking the bus and stop letting his parents drive him back and forth. Then his parents called me to ask whether it could be true that I had asked him to do so. First of all, I could not comment to them about it until I had a consent form from him. Second, I thought that he, and not his parents, should talk to me about it. At some point, his lease was terminated, and instead of looking for a new place to live, he moved back in with his parents again. His parents fell back into the same roles that they had had before, and, after a while, they wanted the therapy sessions to stop. They thought that they lived too far away to drive their son to therapy, and they were struggling with all the demands and responsibilities that they had to be willing to give him. The process was therefore interrupted. This example is far from unique. The young man had been diagnosed with what, and this is crucial, was not a serious mental illness. But he remained stuck in the diagnosis and found it difficult to break out of it, partly because he had been stripped of any responsibility. His psychological disorder was not really a reason not to take responsibility for his own life, and he could have had a much better life than he had with a simple strategy. Overdiagnosing him ended up creating a person who could not cope without massive support, even though he had plenty of opportunities to take responsibility for his own life and demonstrate agency. We can always make the choice to choose based on the conditions we are subject to, and to make the choices that we can make.